Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Now we're starting the podcast. This is Matt.
This is Chrissy.
Christy.
I thought you were going to have us do it.
Well, and Ben. And it's Ben.
Perfect.
Did we get it? I think we nailed it. We'll fix it in post-production.
Just like we talked about in the pre-production meeting. Welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast. We're going to talk about anger today, anger in Christian leadership and its dysfunction. Right, Ben?
Yeah, dysfunction, how anger functions, but we went with a little dis in front of it. Like a little clever title, if I can manage one.
You managed it. You managed it just fine.
Thank you.
But first, we're recording this intro here at the what is really the end of summer for those of us who have kids.
Yeah, school's right? About to start.
School's about to start. My kids are a week away from school starting. It's unbelievable how fast summer went by. I'm going to ask a question, and you guys are going to have to answer.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't make the rules. What did you learn this summer? What did you learn this summer?
That's a loaded question, Matt.
Is it?
This is a very open-ended question. I don't know what it would be loaded with, though. That makes me wonder about what your answer is going to be, Christy.
What did you learn this summer?
I feel like go ahead.
I'll go with a light, just a light one. That's still a good learning. I learned that I think I prefer to take vacation 1 week at a time.
Did you do that several times?
We did that. Well, we did that this, we actually haven't taken our second week of vacation yet. We usually take 2 weeks in the summer, and the past few years we've taken 2 weeks in a row. Okay. And this, summer we were doing reunions with my side of the family and then with Deb's side of the family. And so we couldn't manage to do 2 weeks in a row. And so we have them spread out a little bit, and I found that I actually kind of like that better, I think.
I like it.
That's one thing I learned.
That's good.
About myself.
That is interesting. How about you, CP?
I feel it's a little bit more heavy.
I just thought start us out in the shallow end, and you can take us into the depths.
I feel like I am learning, but have learned maybe, that you got to laugh and you got to cry. And what I mean by that is, so my dad is living with us right now. He's been with us for 2.5 months and he has Alzheimer's, and there's something that happens every day that is pretty funny. And if most of the time I just need to laugh about it, but there's also times I need to cry about it, but I actually need to do both. And I'm trying to learn like that's okay. So like somebody came to pick up my daughter at one of like a mentor, and my dad answered the door, and she's like, "Hey, I'm here to get Brie." And my dad's like, "Oh, she just left for Hawaii." And of course Kira's like behind, and she's like, "No, she didn't. She's here," you know. And you just have to kind of laugh. Like most of the time when he's making up some story, it's really delightful. But then there are moments, like the other day where he comes up, Brie has a friend over, and my dad's in his underwear, and Brie's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I'm just getting lunch." And she's like, "Go put on clothes." You know, like she was super embarrassed. And that was, although it's really funny, there was a grief of like, he was so unaware of what was happening and what he needed, and just how the disease is taking over, that I that day went up and cried it out in my room. And I need to do both. And so I'm learning to just express the funny and laugh about things and like, yep, that's silly, and not be so serious. But then the moments where there's a lump in my throat, I take the time to actually process the grief.
Yeah.
That's really good, Christine. Do you think it was hard? Like, I imagine it would be hard to give yourself permission to laugh at the funny stuff.
Oh, yeah.
because it's also kind of tragic. You know what I mean? Like the reason it's happening is there's this disease ravaging his brain. But there was, but it's almost like you're saying it's okay. It is funny. And it's, you're not, I don't know. You're not like dishonoring him or the situation by doing that.
I don't know. And I think this summer has been me learning that it's okay to laugh about some things and it's okay to cry about some things.
Yeah.
So what about you, Matt?
Yeah. Well, before I answer, Chrissy, I think too that like laughter does a lot of different work.
Mm. Yeah.
And you're naming like some of the work it does, which is there's layers to what's going on with your dad.
Yeah.
And there's ways to handle things in the moment to keep things from coming to a complete stop.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's, yeah, like feeling two things at once can be really difficult. Giving yourself permission to feel things two things at once can be difficult. And in particular, like, I think it's more culturally acceptable to be sad about dementia than it is to laugh at it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When we laugh at it, we tend to feel bad or guilty or ashamed. Like, you know, this really isn't funny or, you know, am I making fun of someone who is vulnerable?
Right.
You know, those kinds of thoughts go through our head. And so it can be hard to feel two things at once. It can be hard to give ourselves permission to laugh at things that we feel maybe we shouldn't laugh at. And sometimes there are situations where laughing would be inappropriate or do cause harm. But I think, I don't know, I'm just pondering that. Mm. You know, something I learned this summer is to be the person who asks the questions and doesn't answer them.
No.
This week on the Gravity Commons podcast.
Oh my gosh. Time out. You do not get off the hook. I'm feeling two things right now at the same time, Matt.
Oh yeah? What do you mean?
Anger and very angry.
What have I learned this summer? I've learned to change my schedule so that I battled sleep for a long time. And I've learned how most nights to put myself back to sleep when I wake up. That's a new thing, like a mental hack. And I've also learned to not feel bad when I go to bed at 8:30. I used to feel bad. I still feel like I miss out on, like, my kids are teenagers now and they got all those hormones and their circadian rhythms are crazy. And so like 10:45 p.m. is when they want to talk.
Oh yeah.
That's when they had the most energy and they want to talk. And I've usually been asleep for an hour and a half by then.
Yep.
So part of me feels bad about that, but then I know that I'm a C-minus dad if I only get 4 hours of sleep. So anyway, I'd rather be a B-minus dad asleep than a C-minus dad awake.
That's where Sharon steps in. She'll be like, tell me what you want to tell me.
Can't hurt the kids' feelings if I'm asleep.
Oh, my goodness.
You've heard of passive neglect.
This is passive care.
That's active neglect. Anyway, that's what I'm learning lots of other things, but maybe we'll save that for a future podcast. I appreciate you both answering that question.
Yeah, I appreciate yours.
Thanks for asking.
Today, who do we have?
Today, we've got Rick Pidcock. He's coming back to the podcast, and we're chatting about, like I said before, anger. Rick writes for Baptist News Global. He's got a Master's of Arts degree in worship from Northern Seminary. And he's the host of the Baptist News Global podcast, Highest Power, Church and State. He also writes on Substack. You can find his writing at rickpidcock.substack.com. And today we're chatting about an article he wrote for the Baptist News Global website on allegations against a Christian leader and an investigation about it and what it can teach us about anger. So you'll see links in the show notes to those articles if you want to hit pause and read them before you listen, or you can just jump right in.
Can dive right in.
That's what I'd do.
You can do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do what you want.
All right. Let's get into it.
Let's dive in.
Hey, Rick, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Rick, you've been on before, and most of our listeners, I assume, are familiar with you. But for those who aren't, tell us a bit about yourself, your journey, maybe, from like worship leader, church, janitor, to to stay-at-home dad and journalist.
Yeah, definitely. So I graduated, I grew up in fundamentalism, like John MacArthur was considered a compromising liberal, you know, and and then I ended up, went to Bob Jones University, got a degree in Bible, and wanted to become more in mainstream conservative evangelicalism. You know, I was part of the like young, restless, reformed type world, Acts 29. So I was involved with a church plant out in Denver. And ended up having some pastoral abuse issues there that we ended up having to leave over, and then was in Sovereign Grace for a little bit.
Oh,
and then all the C.J. Mahaney abuse stuff started coming out, so we left there. Went to moved back to South Carolina, where I was at a mega church for 7 years, and that was where I started a journey with the 10,000 Fathers worship school. Now they're called 10,000 Fathers and Mothers. And basically that was where everything began to shift for me. They told us on the first night of our meeting that we needed to have God awareness and self-awareness. And I'd never thought about self-awareness before. So I thought, well, that would be interesting. So basically through that journey, like I started to realize I had no idea how hurt I was. And through that, starting to grieve my story, and then also had to start reading people that I thought were heretics. You know, these are like really out there people like N.T. Wright and Henry Nouwen, you know, and because they weren't the Calvinist conservative evangelical guys like MacArthur in that. And so basically like by learning to, by grieving my own wounds and doing it in community with others, I began to see the wounds of the people I was going to church with, and as my neighbors, I began to see myself in them, and then also learning to read people that I disagreed with, and that just opened. It just was like a it was a seed that was planted that continued to grow until I started having some questions about my God awareness, which was very much shaped by this top down sovereignty over theology.
Yeah, it's interesting. What years were you involved with 10,000 Fathers?
About 2015.
Yeah.
16, that's, somewhere there.
That's interesting because that kind of parallels or mirrors Ben and my story. We were a part of an organization that was adjacent to 2,000 Fathers, I would say. Like the guy who started it, Aaron Keyes, he's a friend. And he had been orbiting in another ministry that we were a part of. And so a lot of the DNA or ethos of 10,000 Fathers was similar to what we were swimming in as well, but it also did some of the same work for us, Rick, that it did for you, which was like bring just some clarity, some awareness, some perception, and begin to wed or intentionally marry God awareness with self-awareness.
Yeah, and it also like it wasn't like an intellectual exercise for me so much. Like it wasn't like, oh, I doubt young earth creationism and I start to doubt inerrancy, like these topics. It was more of like a softening of my heart toward myself and my neighbor, to where certain theologies that I held to really, I began to realize how those were numbing my wounds and were causing a lot of my wounds. And they were, when I would, to embrace those theologies felt to me like it would be to harden my heart again. Once again, toward myself and my neighbor. And I just couldn't do that anymore. And so from there, I went to a Northern Seminary to pursue a degree in worship. And I was leading worship this whole time, which was kind of funny because, like, as a worship leader in church ministry, you're interacting with the pastors all the time at mm-hmm. the top of the hierarchy. But then professionally, I was a janitor. And so I'm cleaning their toilets, you know, as well. And so you have this, it's a really weird two worlds to be in where you're strategizing and you're the guy who gets looked down on and isn't taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, from there, basically, was really struggling financially. We had to leave that church again too. After the theological disconnect just became too much for us, after a bit with that journey. And then, I basically was like, you know, we got to the point where, we weren't sure how we were going to make it financially. And we thought, you know, Ruth Ellen has a degree in interior design. We had been the complementarian marriage, you know, for 20 years. It was like, why do I have all this pressure on myself to provide for the family all by myself? Like, these are all scripts that's, again, given to me by my theology. I shouldn't have to have that pressure, especially when she's got this ability to make money in interior design that I can't make cleaning toilets. Mm-hmm. And so we switched roles. She got a job full-time in interior design, and then I became a stay-at-home dad and with the desire to pursue my writing, which is what I always wanted to do anyways. So.
Mm. Yeah. And your Substack is called Living La Vida Slippery Slope.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's cool. And so now part of what you do is you write. Tell us about how you discovered a penchant for that and how you got into that.
Yeah, so I actually started writing at like age 5, basically. And I don't mean like that's when I learned how to write, but like, you know, I had actual books.
Yeah, go into detail. How did you learn to hold a pencil?
So we had this paper that had dotted lines down the center. No, so like, but I did books back then, you know, and everything. And excuse me. I always really wanted to get into it. And I started blogging like in 2004 when Blogspot came out.
Yeah.
And, but I just, over the years, I really wanted to do it. I wanted to be just like Josh Harris, you know?
Oh.
Yeah, so that tells you a little bit about my past. but it's really hard to focus on it a lot when you're barely making ends meet and you're working till 10 o'clock at night or pulling all-nighters, you know? And so it's like, it just, when I finally became a stay-at-home dad, I had the space to focus on it more after we got the kids in school. Because when it first started, we had 5 homeschool kids, and that was not really conducive to investing in writing. So,
yes. Yeah. And so now I primarily read your stuff at your Substack, which is, I think, new. And also your articles for Baptist News. And that's one of the things we wanted to chat about today, because you recently wrote a couple articles about an abuse investigation into a fairly well-known progressive ministry leader, Tim Whitaker, who leads the New Evangelicals. And this isn't the first abuse scandal you've written about. So maybe by way of easing into this discussion, what is it about these kinds of stories that you find intriguing?
So I really personally don't like drama, and I don't like to argue, and I don't like having to especially deal with people that I personally know. That's very triggering for me, and given my past. And so, but for me, like the degree that I got in worship, well, like, The spiritual journey I went on with 10,000 Fathers really softened my heart toward my neighbor and myself. And then with the degree I got in worship from Northern Seminary, I began to see, like, on paper how hierarchy works, how empire works. And so it just became so clear, so obvious to see how these things map on to real life through that journey. And so to me, and I'm good at putting into words what a lot of people are feeling, but haven't really had the words to put in, you know, the way to put it into words themselves. And so, to me, it's a responsibility, but it's like, there's a softening vulnerability to it as well. Like, I need to, there are hurting people that I'm in and among, and, I need to, you know, share my platform with them to allow them to give voice to the grief and hurt that they're experiencing. And a lot of times that ends up being with dealing with conservative stories, because those are pastors who they use the gospel to sacralize top-down hierarchies. But in this story, it was different because it was a progressive ministry that spends a lot of time doing things I agree with in exposing the top-down theologies that are used to harm people and put people in their place. And yet there was still this, you know, these power dynamics happening there.
Hmm. And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Yeah, you know, Rick, we're doing this series that this podcast is part of on anger, just because I think there's a lot for us to grow into and learn, I think, as Christians in sort of working through anger. Some of us have been told, you know, that it's, you should never express anger at all. And then other people have sort of leaned on their anger to sort of get things done, as a way to sort of dominate, as a way to push things through, that kind of thing. And anger played a central role in these accusations that you wrote about. Tim was accused of a misuse of power that centered on his anger towards a subcontractor that he'd hired to work with him. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about anger in this story. Like, how did his anger play a role in these allegations?
Yeah. And so in this particular story, there was some issues where he had given her some work to do, but also wasn't that well prepared in the things that he had given her to do. And so she was running a bit late. It led to, they had to take a car ride together. And so then he was angry driving in a way that made her feel very unsafe. And like, just the way you framed that question there, you talked about this person who's in charge over a subcontractor. There's the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And the way they're relating to the person beneath them is through anger and power over. And so, like, I think one thing that stands out to me in this story is how social location affects your anger.
Yes. Yes.
Because, like, and I'm not saying that he viewed her as a slave. This is just an illustration. Like, the anger of a slave owner over their slave for not reaching their expectations is fundamentally different than the anger of a slave who is angry about their enslavement and wanting liberation. And so I'm not of the mindset that anger is all bad, that that we need to both sides this thing, you know, the anger of the slave owner, and then on the other side you got the anger of the slave. Like, they're just not equivalent. Right. And so I think one of the things I wanted to bring attention to is just some self-awareness of how your social location in a relationship affects what anger means in that relationship.
Yes.
Yes. What anger does in that relationship, right? That there's you have to go beyond just the raw feeling of anger, which is, as you said, like a totally normal part of human experience is to feel anger. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. whether it's rational or not, you know, I stub my toe and I feel irrationally angry at the wall, right? It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I'd like swear at the wall, right? That kind of thing. So like we all experience anger for various, you know, for various reasons, you know, anger when our will is thwarted in some way. But the beyond that is what we really need to think about in terms of like, okay, what is my anger doing based on my social location, based on my authority in this relationship, based on my accountability, like all of those things have to go into our reckoning with what our anger is doing and how we're working through it, how we're dealing with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I think like one of the reasons why I feel like this story was so important to write. And again, I didn't want to write it because I know Tim. I have interacted with him. I've hung out with him in person, not just on camera. And so like, it was very uncomfortable for me to write. But one of my concerns was that a lot of conservatives, when they see stories like this, they'll say, it happens in progressive spaces too. So therefore we can dismiss any progressive critiques of hierarchy. And right. I'm like, well, okay. Like we need to examine the situation and be honest about it, because I think what it shows us is like, it doesn't mean we can just leave the hierarchical power over relational dynamics. I think what it means is we need to be honest about the fact that we haven't gone far enough
right.
in reflecting on how we embody mm-hmm. this power over dynamic. Yes. And that's something that's not just an intellectual thing. Like you switched from that idea to this idea. There's an embodied theology here and an embodied posture that we need to continue to reflect on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really great point. I think because you're right, there can be a response to this that's like, well, see, it's useless, you know, like you can, this is inevitable. You know what I mean? There's almost this like acquiescing to abuse, you know, just saying, well, it's just inevitable. It's just going to happen. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's almost, I think the last time we talked with you, we were talking about the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, that podcast. We were talking about Wasn't that it?
Yeah.
Did we talk to you about that? Yeah, that's right. So, but I think there's something similar going on there where there is this, it's very convenient, I think, to try to locate the wrongness purely inside of somebody. Like, you know, like, yeah, I don't know. You know, every once in a while, you're going to have a Mark Driscoll. Every once in a while, you're going to have a leader who, you know, just abuses their authority. And that's the only problem that we're going to deal with. And who knows, you know, sometimes that happens. But I think I like what you're saying that like, no, what this shows us is not that it's useless to try to critique this stuff. It just shows us how far we have to go yet in critiquing it. It's not just about the idea of it. It's not just about changing the content. It's not just about saying that these things are wrong, but it's about really examining how are these power dynamics? How is this way of using anger? How is it showing up in my relationships? You know, even if I'm on the quote right side of it. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I think too that being if you're committed to undoing or rectifying unjust hierarchies. We have to deal with how that hierarchy lives in us too. That it's not simply a decision, and now we have we've made a decision not to have sort of this top-down John MacArthur as a liberal hierarchy, and now we can just live as though it doesn't impact us. But these ways of being live in our bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, we're enculturated, we're formed and shaped by them, and so we have to reckon with. how that lives in us, which I thought was really prominent or came forward in this story because, you know, this anger driving and then the person in the car, this is all in your article, which we'll link in the show notes. She tried to, you know, approach Tim and there was mediation and it was unsatisfying for her. And so Grace got involved. Godly response to abuse in the Christian environment. And they released a report that called for some accountability and follow-up. I wonder, Rick, if you can summarize, like, what's been the response by the New Evangelicals and Tim to that report?
Yeah, so there were a lot of recommendations, things like, you know, decenter Tim Whitaker because he's like, you know, the main face. He was basically all their videos. And they had been doing some decentering by including a few other voices here and there, but it was like still mainly him, you know.
Yeah.
So get more faces on there. And then they had some educational stuff as far as like you need to learn about these different manifestations of abuse, things like that. And so that was kind of they also need to like rethink some of the stuff with their board and the makeup of that and everything. So like, basically like I posted the article and TNE said, and Tim have publicly said, we agree with the findings of the article or of the Grace report. And so to me, like, I'm like, okay, well then that's permission. In my mind that, okay, we agree with the findings. We agree with the recommendations. So we should be able to name what those are and then make sure we're following those things. And then further reflect on how some of these stuff, you know, are still embodied within us. And so I posted the article on social media and within 14 minutes, Tim called me. And it was like,
he said, thank you so much, Rick, for bringing this to light. It really helps in my accountability and reformation.
So that phone call was rather intense to say the least. And, it's interesting because like, okay, like a lot of people I've heard people characterize it as like, Tim was like yelling and railing at me. That wasn't really the nature.
No.
He wasn't berating me. But like at the very beginning, like I tried to, like, I knew this could be tense. I felt uncomfortable. And so I tried to like, lower the
you tried to ameliorate the situation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So like, I just mentioned how my kid just lost a dime, you know? And so I'm like dealing with my kid's crisis to find his dime. Like, you know, so it was supposed to be like a lighthearted thing. You know, and it was, but then all of a sudden, like, it just switched. And he's like, you know, I'm gonna do you a favor and tell you that every, you know, your article had so many things in it that wasn't true. I don't remember the exact quote off the top of my head, but it was like, whoa, like, it was like really direct, really intense. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, there was this power dynamic set up where I'm now in need of a favor and I'm like being confronted. And yet, so I just like pulled up my article and I was like, okay, where are the factual errors? And I wasn't being pointed to any. And we got into a back and forth about like the definition of abuse and how I used that word in the article. And different things from like that. And so it was just, it was pretty tough. And so I think like there's these like public videos that TNE has put out. That's very smiley, you know, and we're doing what we're following the recommendations. And then there are conversations that happen behind the scenes. And sometimes there's a disconnect between, you know, the content an organization puts out, and the phone conversations that happened behind the scenes.
Yeah. So what happened was you wrote an article about a ministry leader misusing anger in a way that ultimately led to an investigation and some recommendations to deal with that person's impact on the organization. And in response to that article, you became the object of that person's anger.
Yes.
Yeah. And something you know, something I noticed as we're talking here is that in both instances, Tim's anger at the subcontractor and at you was about, seems to be about how Tim experienced the wrong of the other person personally. So his anger was coming from a place of personal inconvenience. You know, the subcontractor was late to a meeting, or your spotlight on this, you know, is kind of embarrassing maybe, or, I'm reminded of, Aubrey Hendricks Jr. in his book, The Politics of Jesus. Rick, I'm not sure if you've read that, but he talks about 7 political strategies that Jesus has, and, strategy 5, and he points to Jesus here, and he says, Jesus saves his anger for the mistreatment of others.
Interesting.
And I think that's I bring it up here because it's so clear to me that the anger in this story isn't about somebody else being wronged and now I'm going to move towards that wrong or that person with kind of an anger that's seeking justice, but rather it's a personal offense that I'm taking umbrage at. I wonder if you agree with that categorization here and maybe reflect on what, like, the difference that makes.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense as long as we still keep into the conversation, the social location of the person. So like, I would have no problem with a slave, for example, being angry about how they themselves are being treated.
Yeah.
They should be angry about the way their neighbors are treated. But they should, I think it's okay for them to be angry about how they're treated too. And, but when the slave owner is angry about how they're being treated by their slaves, talking about the power dynamic, that's a fundamentally different thing. And so like I have very little space in my mind and heart for slave owners being angry about history being written about them.
Yeah, if you're angry about the truth being told about you, maybe you need to be different. Mm-hmm.
Especially when you've publicly said with a smile that you agree with the findings. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the way I make sense of it, Rick, is that there lives in us this like devastating fear that we'll be wrong, you know, or that we'll fail. Like we have this allergy to shame that's probably born of our relationship to toxic shame. Mm-hmm. So we've never really been formed and shaped and cultured into spaces where it's a relief that our evil's uncovered, or it's a gift that there's public accountability, or it's a grace that I get to be involved in reparation work to heal and mend what I've broken. And what strikes me is that that's so rare. Like when somebody's found out, whether it's a conservative person or progressive person, that it's so rare for that person to be like, "Ugh, you're right. I need help in this. I needed help for a long time. And I'm really eager to learn the things that make for peace." Wouldn't that be nice? I found myself, Rick, on social media, you had some people rushing to Tim's defense. And it was kind of oblique, right? It was like, well, what are you going to do? You going to cancel him? You know, you're going to, does he now no longer get to be anywhere? You know, does he no longer get to say anything? I wonder if you could reflect a bit on, like, in your mind, as you think about, you know, you've gone through two of these experiences yourselves in local congregations. Now, you know, in writing about a story, you actually become part of the story in some ways here. What are some of the things that either you've seen that are helpful, or what would you like to see happen as a result of the story?
I think one thing I think a lot of us content creators need to think about is, like, why we do the things we do, and how we incorporate other voices. Like, you can still incorporate voices of the marginalized on your content in ways that is like a power over dynamic.
Speaking of like tokenizing or?
It's still kind of centering me, if that makes sense. And I think a lot of us, like, yeah, we've built platforms and stuff, but we need to, like, be not seeing and taking our platform and holding onto it so much. We need to see our platform in these self and neighbor relationship dynamics. And I'm not just obligated to put an article out every week and two podcasts out every week. Like, this is an opportunity for me to look around and see where the hurt is this week in the news, and then to bring out voices of the marginalized and help them get their voice out. And that's because technically I have a responsibility to put out an article and two podcasts a week. And so I could muscle through that and share my, you know, bloviations on everything through those. And I could even put out, like, I'm going to have a Black woman on this week, you know, to show how diverse I am. Or, like, it's going to be different if you actually embody the self and neighbor working toward liberation mindset. And if that means me taking a back seat, or, you know, whatever that might be, me taking some time off, like I don't feel precious about, my position there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Let's get back to the show.
A fairly well-known, like a podcast host that was part of this podcast that was kind of part of this, I don't know, progressive, there was, you know, deconstruction. There was a lot of these things that this person was, like, very prominently sort of featured in those circles, right? As, like, a very well-known podcaster. And then basically just, like, disappeared, you know, like, from the public standpoint, like, you just, you know, he stopped doing the podcast and you stopped hearing about him. But I had heard that what he had decided to do was to say that he didn't feel like what I heard him explain. I can't remember the context for this, but I heard him explain that he didn't feel like he was a white man, and he didn't feel like, as a white man, centering his voice in the public square, even though it was for, you know, the marginalized, even though it was for these sort of progressive causes, he felt like there was this dynamic happening that he could not unwind himself from, where it was like, but still, me as a white man, I keep getting centered and I keep getting lifted up, and I don't like that, and I would rather do something else with my time. And so he basically started, I think he started some kind of a fund that and sort of works with Black women who want to open businesses or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like that, where he was just like, this is me, this, like, I don't like this dynamic that I'm noticing. And the choice that he made to do that was to sort of take this back seat and say, I think I'm better suited to, like, help people start businesses rather than
go on podcasts and talk about how we should do this kind of stuff. Hmm. So anyway, I was just reminded of that story as you were talking, that there's this, I guess that's maybe an example of what you're talking about, this embodied, like one way of embodying this stuff rather than just sort of, just sort of talking about it and assuming that that's enough or a good thing.
Yeah. Cause like the way the empire works is that it strengthens the power of those at the top and dehumanizes those below and then wages war against those who won't submit. And you can do that through any kind of ideologies. You know, and any kind of platform, you can be, you can dehumanize people by placing them into your little roles that you've got within your empire to strengthen your power. And so I think, you know, self-awareness is so important in this conversation.
Yeah.
And understanding how hierarchy works and being willing to recognize it in your own body and the embodied relationships that you have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And two, there's also this, even wider than self-awareness, I feel like there's this like system awareness that we have to cultivate. Because some of these things operate even with the best of intentions, even with the purest of hearts. I remember reading this book a long time ago that talked about how...
Was it the Bible?
Oh, yeah. That was it. Yeah. Okay. The Christian Bible. I read it a long time ago, just all the way through. And I was like, that's enough for me.
That's probably good.
Yeah. No, it was a book. Man, I wish I could remember the name of the book. But it was basically about how capitalism works to basically take this countercultural revolution stuff, like the stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s, like with the hippies and everything. Like the counterculture was trying to like stand up to the system. But the way that capitalism works is that it grabs hold of that energy and then like packages it and sells it back to people as a commodity, where it's just like, oh yeah, great. You can be a hippie. That's great. Here's a t-shirt, you know, buy the t-shirt, buy the hippie t-shirt. You can be a punk rocker, buy the punk rock t-shirt, you know, and it basically has this way of like sneakily selling things back to you in a way that makes you feel like I'm making a difference, but actually you like... you're just still participating in this system. Anyway, so I've just, like, since reading that, I think there's this nefarious, you just have to be aware, you have to be self-aware, like you said, but also like, maybe we could call it systems aware of like, how are my best intentions? Like what's actually happening, right? Socially, politically, as I try to do this good thing, what's actually happening? I have to pay attention to that.
Yeah. And I don't know when this podcast is going to go out, but we're recording it right after Good Friday and Easter. Mm-hmm. And like, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about over the last week in particular is how this, how anger is talked about at the cross and how these power dynamics are talked about in conversations about the cross. Because in the conservative world that I always, you know, grew up in, it was about the Father at the top, satisfying his wrath on Jesus by violently punishing him on the cross. It's this top-down violence and anger exhaustion. And yet when I actually like read the account of the cross, I see Jesus saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Like Jesus was recognizing these people aren't aware of the systems they're participating in. Yes. They're not aware of a lot of the motivations that are, you know, they're being driven by. Yes. And so I think one of the things we need to fundamentally rethink is the way we think about what happened at the cross with these power dynamics and with the anger dynamic of it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the hazards, I think, of having any kind of platform. I mean, Rick, we'll talk about your podcast here in a bit, but you know, you are a visible journalist. You have a large following online. People appreciate and benefit from what you say. And so developing a platform in our political economy comes with hazards that we are unable to actually have a platform in differentiated ways that make sense culturally and not be bound up in some of these systemic issues, you know? And so I think it's it's just a hazard of living in our political economy that we can't assume, okay, my motivations are good, my intentions are good. You know, I'm letting the hierarchicalists have it. So I will be immune from the abuses of power that predominate in our world. I think that's naive, foolish, and I think this story illustrates that. Maybe as we close here, I want to just maybe double click on two things. The first is, I wonder if you can reflect on, you know, I do think that sort of white conservative Christianity has earned the moniker of being like, of not dealing well with abuse and of almost being, I would say usually in many instances, unintentionally incubating abuse through theology and commitments to hierarchies, et cetera. But you made a real point in this podcast, even now, but also in the articles, to address something happening in a progressive space that actually is trying to name and reckon with abuse and has been kind of a safe haven for many people who are trying to come out of harmful systems and patterns. Can you talk about maybe what would it, as we seek to not just be blind to the sins of our own group or tribe, but to name them and address them? What do we have? Meaning, those of us who want to reckon with the injustice of hierarchies, what do we have available to us to handle and deal with, you know, the harmful effects of anger? And how does that apply in this situation?
I think one of the things that people in progressive spaces wrestle with is, like, we're so averse to the fundamentalisms of our past. And something I'll notice is a lot of progressive people critique the abuses of conservative Christianity, they'll talk about fundamentalism and how it is so dependent on black and white thinking. And so then a lot of progressives will then try to stay away from black and white thinking. There's like a, you know, one response is like this both sides, like everybody's a fundamentalist. And somehow you're something different, but there's this aversion to black and white thinking and making dogmatic statements. And that's something I've seen in the response to this story is people tell me, because I wrote my articles, I'm being a fundamentalist too. And having black and white thinking. And what I think is something that we need to realize is, you know, we need to have clarity and accountability. And yes, clarity and accountability is not a fundamentalist black and white thinking. No. And we can have clarity, we can have accountability by growing in our awareness of ourselves, our neighbors, and the systems that we're participating in, and feeling the liberation of knowing that God's posture toward us when we don't know what we're doing is one of forgiveness and love and not top-down anger shaming. Mm-hmm. And I think that provides a lot of freedom for us as we talk about these things.
Yes. I think what a corollary to that, the fundamentalist thing is, I you know, just for whatever it's worth, Rick, I don't think you're being a fundamentalist here in naming this. And I think it's a bit of a, it's a bit of sea lining, meaning it's a bit of misdirection and deflection, because all of us have fundamental values that when transgressed are black and white. Yeah. You know, Rick has 5 kids. And if you're a friend of Rick and you come over and you're committed to the mistreatment of one of his children, he's going to be a fundamentalist about opposing that mistreatment.
Right.
And that's righteous, right, Rick?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the pathologizing of having values that are non-negotiables for you is a dead end, because we all have them. We all have them. So I just want to highlight your call for clarity and accountability, like transparency and like mutually responsible relationships where someone actually has to answer to somebody else at quote the top, mm-hmm. is fundamental in developing systems, organizations, communities that are increasingly allergic to abuse. I don't know if there's any other way.
Yeah, because if you have a presence in and among the oppressed at the bottom of the empire, you're going to have some clarity and accountability toward regarding those who are hurting them, or your heart is going to be hardened toward those around you, or it's going to be numbed toward those around you. A softening of the heart toward self and neighbor at the in and among the oppressed requires clarity and accountability over the way they're being hurt.
Yes. All right. Well, Rick, I know you're coming off of a illness, right?
Yes.
And so I appreciate your taking some time with us today to chat about these things. Maybe as we close here, where is this story at now? Are there any further developments you can share with us, or like what's going on with the story now?
I think right now we're kind of all in a bit of a waiting and seeing as far as how the specific story with Tim Whitaker and the new evangelicals is going to turn out. I mean, Tim's gone back to starting, literally the week after, started back on the podcasts and everything. So they're asking for more time, to put the grace recommendations into practice. And I personally feel like other people could be providing videos and content right now if that's what you really need to do. I guess we're kind of just having to wait and see how they evolve that over time at this point. So,
yeah. Tell us about your podcast. This is a new thing you're doing, and I want our listeners to know about it.
Yeah. So I have a podcast right now with Baptist News Global called The Highest Power Church and State. And so basically it's basically this where I'm interacting twice a week with the stories in the news. We're talking about whether you're talking with politics or within the church itself, like how both of these worlds are people that are trying to ascend to the highest power. And then within those two worlds, like the church versus the state, like especially with Christian nationalism, how certain people are trying to posture their particular religious purposes over their neighbors in, through the state. And so basically it's just kind of, watching the news and then seeing what needs to be talked about regarding some of these power dynamics that we have. And so I'll often do some episodes by myself, or I'll interview some people to get their perspectives on things.
Yeah. Great. Cool. Well, Rick, I appreciate the work you're doing. I know this work led to you incurring some, maybe we could call it moral injury. And so I just want to recognize that. It's not, there's a cost to speaking about these things and talking about these things. And I appreciate you storing up in your ear holes what's lacking in the cross of Christ for all of us, so we can know about what's going on. And just bless your work, man. Thank you.
And thank you.
So I have some thoughts that I'd love to unpack a little bit here, Ben, about what Rick said. Mm-hmm. Are you okay with that? Are you prepared?
Well, I did click record, so I'm as prepared as I can be. No, I'm kidding. Obviously. Yeah, let's talk.
Yeah, so I love the really clear articulation about how the anger of the slaveholder mm-hmm. isn't commiserate and equal to the anger of the enslaved.
Right. Right.
How would you unpack that or explain that to somebody who doesn't get it?
Yeah.
I think that coheres for me immediately. I'm like, of course.
Yeah.
But I know people in my life who don't get that. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about why they don't get it or how you would unpack it so they could more helpfully understand it.
Yeah. You know, I think the when we talk about slaveholders and slaves, that's like this situation that feels a long ways away from our current situation, right? It's like, and it's sort of like the civil rights movement where everybody, like after civil rights, everybody's like, oh yeah, obviously we were all on, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.'s side. Like we all believe that now. I mean, you know, present events notwithstanding. So I think there's a tendency to resist identifying oneself with, you know, a slaveholder. I think there's a tendency to deny maybe the cultural power that we have because it, I don't know, sometimes it feels like a personal indictment. Sometimes it's hard to see it, honestly. You know what I mean? So, I think that let's like, it feels super clear that the slaveholder's anger is different from the slave's anger. But then I think in hindsight, none of us feel like the slaveholder in our current, mm-hmm. you know, situation. And so, and when we're called on that, I mean, I feel this in my body. Like if I don't know, interrupt a woman, you know what I mean? Or I sort of do some of these habits that are ingrained in me as a white man, even though I don't want to do them and I think they're wrong, I still do them. And when somebody points it out, like I feel this defensiveness rise up in me. Like, no, that's not what I was doing. You know what I mean? Like I feel that and I have to make this conscious decision to be like, okay, like you're not going to die if you just admit that you were wrong. If you're not, you know, and I think that's part of it, Matt. I think it's just so hard for us to admit when we misuse power.
Yes. And no one wants to be compared to a slaveholder.
Right. I mean, that's right. Yeah. They're like, you know, terrible people, right? I mean, that's kind of how we think about it. And yeah, we don't want to admit that. I think it's hard. I think it's hard for those reasons.
Yeah. We talked a little bit. We were at the Post-Evangelical Collective earlier this week. And it was in Nashville. Great people, wonderful time. But we had a conversation, you and I led, about leading as white men, and reckoning with supremacy, reckoning with supremacy cultures, right? And one of the comments that was made is that like supremacy cultures are purity cultures, mm-hmm. meaning purity cultures have to be right. And if anybody is wrong, they have to be corrected or eliminated. So if they're wrong, they need to recant mm-hmm. from the established dogma of the supremacy culture, right? So if you're in a supremacy culture and you start talking about white supremacy, you either have to recant of thinking white supremacy is a problem, or you have to be eliminated from the in-group. You're pushed out.
Right. There's not a lot of room for, you know, diversity of opinion on that, well, on matters of supremacy.
Yeah. And even though part of the supremacy culture, especially white evangelicalism, is, you know, there's a lot of oxygen given to unity and essentials. I'm sorry. What is that phrase? My brain just like checked out.
No, I think it's unity and like essentials,
diversity and charity and non-essentials.
Or yeah, like I don't know. It feels like there's three things.
Yeah, there's three things. I'm gonna look it up. Listener, you're all screaming right now at your windshield, telling us what's going on.
That's not how podcasts work. We can't hear you.
But the point is, the gist of that is, everybody defines essentials differently. Right. Maybe it's the Bebbington Quadrilateral. Maybe it's the Apostles' Creed. Maybe it's the doctrinal statement on the website.
Right.
But what one of the experiments, I've talked about this before, that I ran was, I think there's actually an essential that's unnamed, and that's like supremacy, like white supremacy, male supremacy, and others. Yeah. And so you can find out pretty quick what kind of diversity is tolerated and what isn't by sort of talking about those non-essentials.
Yeah. I found it, by the way. It's in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, in all things charity.
There we go.
That's the phrase.
Yes.
On the surface. Sounds great.
And I guess the point I'm trying to make is not that there isn't essentials. The point is there's a lot of unarticulated, unnamed essentials.
Right.
That have nothing to do with the faith once and for all delivered to the saints.
Right. The stated doctrines. There's more like cultural assumptions that, and behaviors. I think that's part of it too. It's because when we talk about this stuff, oftentimes we're talking about doctrines, we're talking about ideas.
Right.
And so it's like you can hold an idea in your head, but there's, you know, there's a performance and an action that's actually going to be a problem. Not the private holding of the idea, but the
right.
outward performing of something that violates. Anyway.
Yeah. To circle back to the distinction here, I think when I read Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove wrote a book about slaveholder religion. Mm-hmm. And he connects the dots between sort of the theology and practice of slaveholders and the way they understood Christianity and a predominant form of white Christianity, conservative Christianity today. Mm-hmm. I didn't experience that as a threat. I experienced it as a gift, like, oh, this name's something that has bothered me. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's it. Maybe these things have bothered me and I couldn't name them and other people named them for me.
Yeah.
But I think some people hear that analogy, slaveholder, enslaved, or read that book by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, and they experience it as a threat.
Yeah.
You know? And I do think it's an artifact of supremacy that we can't be the bad guys. We can't be the bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that came out in our conversation with Rick. You know, I think, you know, one of the issues with Tim calling Rick and telling him there was tons of flaws in his thing and then, you know, kind of using his personality and power to sort of, you know, whether or not he intended to kind of intimidate or bully, whatever. Rick, is that there just is no capacity there to be wrong.
Yes. Yeah. And there's even, I think, I wonder if there's a subtle temptation in this kind of realm of, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better term, post-evangelicalism, right? So these people who are identifying, especially if you are identifying as like pointing out something wrong in what you're leaving, right? So I'm pointing out the there's several things amiss in this system that I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I think there's a subtle temptation then to feel like, well, I can never be wrong myself because I'm the one who's seeing the wrongness of the system I'm leaving.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm reminded of that Thomas Merton quote, when I criticize a system, they think that I criticize them. And that is, of course, because they fully accept the system and identify themselves with it.
Yes.
And I think that there is, you know, what I think Rick's article was trying to point out and what I think, you know, and I heard a lot of people wrestling with this at the Post-Evangelical Collective, that they were saying, like, it's not enough to just change our ideas. It's not enough to just say, now we have better ideas. But there is a deeper work of sort of dislodging the ways that, you know, supremacy, dislodging the ways that these hierarchies and these systems of value have not just embedded themselves in the way that we articulate ideas, but in our bodies and the way that we respond to criticism and the way that we, you know, respond to being inconvenienced and, you know, all of that kind of thing.
Yes.
It's like a much deeper repentance that is necessary than just, I don't know, the outward stating of, you know, maybe the ridiculousness of 81% of evangelicals voting for Donald Trump.
Right.
Like, it goes so much deeper than just how could you vote for that guy? I'm going to vote for somebody else, to use a sort of surface level example.
Right.
Yeah.
I know we're going long here, but the other thing that I've, you know, mentioned this before and mentioned it with Rick, but I've learned a lot from Aubrey Hendricks and his Politics of Jesus book. And one of his way that he names Jesus's explicit political strategy, one of the strategies is save your anger for the mistreatment of others.
Yeah.
And I really think that is not everything. Right?
Right.
So we can, I think we can still sin in anger at the mistreatment of others.
For sure.
And I think there's still virtue in being angry at our own mistreatment.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not like saying this is a, I'm not making an exclusive totalizing claim here.
Yes.
Which by the way, listener, if you, that is part of our heritage of a supremacy system, is that we hear things and see things in totalizing exclusive ways.
Yes. We have trouble believing that two things can be true at the same time.
And two things can be true to different degrees in different ways at the same time.
Right.
Yes. Right?
Yes.
So you can talk about Barack Obama's endorsing of drones and foreign policy killing children, mm-hmm. and how that's thoroughly evil. And not have to make that equal and commiserate with MAGA.
Right.
Which also does those things and more.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Our friend Seth calls this simultaneity, that we don't have to both sides things.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't have to just focus on one evil.
Yeah.
But we can actually speak in non-exclusive, non-totalizing ways about varying degrees of evil, et cetera.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's a long caveat, Ben,
yeah,
to say.
Go ahead.
I'm only good at a few things, and long caveats are probably not one of them because everybody's lost. But here's the point. The point is, like, one of the rubrics for me is am I personally offended? Is this my ego being like, am I angry and insecure and afraid because I feel like I'm going to lose something? And my response against that is anger. Or is this anger about how someone else is being treated,
yeah.
right? Because I think often my own anger lies to me and tells me that the wrong being done to me sometimes is injustice when it's not injustice.
Right.
I just got my panties in a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I just got my britches crooked.
Yeah.
And my ego's hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is hard sometimes to know the difference between those things. You know, I mean, we've talked about like moral injury, things that can sometimes happen. Like, you know, I've been in situations where as a leader who does have sort of more authority than the people who are criticizing me, mm-hmm. I have felt unfairly criticized, which is really, it's difficult to know how to process that. But I think what you're saying is that as a general rule, if you're upset, I think Aubrey Hendricks, that's a good general rule. Save your anger for the mistreatment of others.
Yes.
And if you are angry about your own, what you perceive to be your own mistreatment, just maybe like take a pause, take a few breaths, maybe talk to some people about it so that you can discern what's really going on here. Is this something where I should be setting a boundary and I should be sort of like advocating for myself?
Yes.
Or is this a situation where I can just say, okay, you're right, I was wrong, you know?
Yes.
Or even if I am being unfairly criticized, is it a situation where I, you know, should advocate for myself or just kind of, you know, like accept it? You know,
yeah.
there's times to do both. So,
Yeah. And so I think, so for instance, like, you know, I think a lot of Christians care a lot about religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that in the public square, a lot of the oxygen is dominated by prayer in schools or Bible in schools, right? Or mm-hmm. Me being able to express my religious convictions in various corporate settings.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But I I actually think that that kind of religious freedom discourse functions in a supremacist way. And a safer, more healthy, more fruitful expression of this is for me to leverage my religious freedom energy on people, for people who are different than me.
Right. For
my Muslim neighbors, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
For people who practice a different religion than mine and who practice a different religion than the dominant expression in the, you know, in the environment that we're in. So religious freedom oftentimes means Christians or people who identify as Christians being able to, you know, do what they want. But yeah, when you do, you know, that's what you're talking about oftentimes.
Yeah.
And the reveal is you don't have any energy to, you know, for someone who wants to practice their Muslim faith or Buddhist faith or whatever they might be wanting to practice, you don't have any problem with them being restricted.
Yeah. So if I'm going to be angry about the compromising of religious freedom, my conviction is I'm going to reserve that act, my action and my emotion and my energy for other people's religious freedom being compromised.
Yeah.
Because if, for instance, Muslims aren't free to express their faith, then none of us are free.
Right.
Right? Yeah. And if only Christians are free or privileged or supreme, then that's not religious freedom. Mm-hmm. That's religious supremacy.
Yeah.
And so that's one example of this. Like, yes, I want Christians to be able to practice their faith publicly, freely. But that doesn't mean without consequence, by the way.
Yeah.
Right? And it also, I think the way to that is to advocate for other people's religious freedom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think the best way to ensure religious freedom for Christians is to advocate for other religions' religious freedom.
Yes.
Now, that's not true all times and all places, but I think it is true for me where I live in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, to advocate for, if you're going to advocate for people being given the right to, you know, defend themselves if they're accused mm-hmm. of a crime or, you know, accused of being a gang member from Venezuela.
Right.
Like
right.
you, if you're going to, if you're concerned about due process, then, you know, save your anger for the people who are not like you, who are being, having their due process rights violated right now.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Being kidnapped and rounded up without any ability to say, hey, you've got the wrong guy, or I didn't do anything wrong. So,
yep.
Anyway.
Well, there's more to be said about this. We're going to explore anger more. And that's me committing publicly to scheduling some more interviews. So here we go.
Hopefully the series will be longer than two podcasts.
I think it will be, Ben. But, okay. You know, you may have...
Stay tuned, listener. Who knows what's going to happen next week? We'll see.
Ben, I'm cooking this weekend, and you're sort of my go-to cooking expert. So okay. I'm wondering what happens when you boil a funny bone.
Oh, I know exactly what happens when you boil a funny bone.
What happens?
I don't know.
It becomes a laughing stock.
A laughing stock, which is a delicious base for funny bone soup. let's get out of here.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.